This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. We were talking about Alex Sesney in the last episode and how he sort of he ends up in a strange situation in the case of Teresa Stone in 1996, where he's been arrested for something unrelated, and as you pointed out, his DNA is collected for the unrelated crime. The unrelated crime is he's alleged to have sexually assaulted an acquaintance and tried to smother her. She gets away. In that case, he ends up acquitted. But the minute he gets acquitted in this acquaintance rape, he gets arrested for the case we talked about yesterday, which was the 1996 rape and murder of Teresa Stone. And when we first looked at this case, you and I sort of looked at it and we went, well, is he de-escalating? And I think the first word, I think maybe the first words out of your mouth when we said, like, is he de-escalating? You were like, did she escape? Like, you know, was she about to be in a similar situation, a similar type of victim to Teresa Stone? Or did she get away?
Right. And so we have to wonder, my understanding was that he was acquitted, like, based on the fact that it was basically he said, she said.
Yes.
And so, you know, that is very gray area as far as, like, well, can we even say because he was acquitted, I mean, essentially that means there's not enough evidence to say he committed the crime, right? I mean.
Yeah.
And so it gets weird, right?
We find ourselves in this weird situation where we're like talking about him. There's a long investigation that takes place around this guy, Alex Sesney. And the Telegram and the Gazette start covering this in 2008. One of their first articles by a guy named Scott Croteau, they talk about the investigation where they mention this other incident. And so I want to be like real specific here. It's no longer a thing where living victims of sexual assault are identified in publications. I'm like, just briefly, I'm going to mention that this alleged attack took place in a West Boylston motel. And so when this attack happens, he was charged with attempting to smother this woman. But what's important about it is even though he's acquitted on it, and by the way, he had a $6,000 cash bail. So the alleged rape occurred on March 17, 2007. He had he had bail where he got out on $6,000 cash bail or bond, as people will call it. That ends up being revoked. So the bail gets revoked because he violated the terms of what's known as pre-trial probation. He pleaded not guilty to the rape charges. This guy has an interesting criminal record. So, and they review this in the Telegram and Gazette. And specifically, they say a review of his criminal records for the past 10 years shows that Mr. Sesney has been charged with choking a woman with a necktie, and attempting to rape her, attacking another woman, and raping a young girl. Now, during this period of 10 years, going back from 2008, so back to 1998, he resided in different places throughout central Massachusetts, and he worked for his family's business, which was Sesney Construction. Outside of central Massachusetts, Alex Sesney was accused of choking a woman and trying to rape her in Harwich, And that's 6 years prior to this article. So that's 2002. And they pulled the official police report for this article. Officers interviewed this woman on March the 3rd of 2002 at the Cape Cod Hospital. Police said that she told him that she met Mr. Szczesny in a local Chinese restaurant, and he allegedly made sexual advances towards her. She told police that the two ended up at Mr. Szczesny's home, where he became aggressive and tried to have sex with her. The woman rejected the advances, according to the police report, at which time Alex Szczesny allegedly grabbed the necktie, tied it around the woman's neck, and began to choke her. The woman told police that she blacked out and then came to, and she found Mr. Szczesny on top of her. Mr. Szczesny allegedly struck her several times, but the woman manages to stop him, and she convinces him to take her home in his white pickup truck. So this is the 2002 attack. Now, he lived in Leominster prior to that. So in the 2002 attack, he ends up arrested. He gets charged with assault with the intent to rape and assault and battery with a dangerous weapon. Prior to that, he was accused of raping a girl under the age of 16 on October the 30th of 1999 in Leominster. At that time, he was living on Mechanic Street when he was charged with this assault. Now, the court records from the Leominster District Court show that he ends up sentenced to 16 months in jail. The bulk of that time was suspended so that he ends up with a year in jail, and then he ends up with probation for the assault and battery. The charge was reduced from rape of a child with force. Now, they don't list the victim's specific age. It just says he's under the age of 16. The sentence ends up being imposed on July the 14th of 2000, and he stays on probation for exactly a year. So on July 13th, 2001, they terminate his probation. Then, if you go back even further, and there are court records indicating that in February of 1996, he was charged with assault and battery stemming from an attack on a woman known to work as a prostitute where he was living at the time. The authorities in that case were unable to locate the victim, so those charges end up dropped. But this is a pretty specific time period because it's close to the time of what happened to Teresa Stone. So in 1996, the year that Mrs. Stone was found dead, Alex Szczesny was living at an address in Maryland, and then he was living at 16 Temple Street in Fitchburg, which puts him in close proximity to the murder of Teresa Stone. Now, what links him to Teresa Stone's case is this West Boylston Motel rape case of an acquaintance. At the time he had written this article, it had not actually come through, but in the 2008 case, he ends up being acquitted. So obviously, this is a violent guy with a history of sexual assault. A lot of times I start to wonder like what those people were up to. It's very similar to the situation with Israel Keyes. Anytime he's not like verified on paper to be somewhere, I get curious in what was he doing. I think the way that you've put it was when you're doing missing persons and unidentified persons reviews and you're reviewing these cases by number, if it happened between, say, January of 1998 and March of 2012, like, and I know that's a broad timeline, but that's sort of the Israel Keyes timeline. We start to look at it and we go, well, where was he during that time? With this guy, I know like he goes to jail, he gets out, he goes to jail, he gets out. He has multiple charges where he doesn't go to jail. So I'm sort of curious where he is. And I'm not the only one. This is one of those cases where they have decided they're going to dub this guy a serial killer. And I don't know how we want to approach this part of it, but I had to go hunt to like find this information. This person becoming a, I'll say, person of interest in multiple murders, it comes from a guy named John Kelly. Now, John Kelly can currently be found on John Kelly's website, literally johnkellyllc.com. Here's his description of Mr. Kelly. John Kelly is an internationally recognized criminal profiler and psychotherapist whose expertise has been valued in over 100 serial murder cases. Some of the more notorious cases include the Long Island serial killer, the Atlantic City serial murders, the Green River killer, the I-70 serial killer, and the Golden State killer. Kelly's involvement in these high-profile murders by serial killers has led to multiple appearances on shows such as CBS's 48 Hours, CNN Primetime with Nancy Grace, the HLN Jane Velez Mitchell Show, and NBC's Sunday Today Show with Lester Holt. He's also been featured in various national newspapers and magazines, such as People Magazine, Forensic Magazine, U.S. News and World Report Magazine, the Boston Herald, the Boston Globe, the New York Times. Furthermore, John Kelly is probably best known for co-hosting the three-season television show Dark Minds on the Investigation Discovery Channel. Not only is John Kelly known for his work as a criminal profiler, he is also the first person to label serial killing as a true addiction, as portrayed in his essay, The Alcohol, Drug, and Serial Killer Connection. So Mr. Kelly is also the founder of an organization where he and a team work together with law enforcement across the country and helping them solve various murder cases. For 25 years, he was also the executive director of Extra Care Health Services, an outpatient counseling center. This was a center for mental health and substance abuse, and it looks like it was located in Old Bridge, New Jersey. His credentials include board-certified forensic examiner, a fellow of the American Board of Forensic Examiners, a New Jersey-certified social worker, and a nationally certified addiction specialist. In addition, John Kelly is a published author of the book Warning Signs, A Guidebook for Parents, and will be releasing a second book in the spring of 2019 called Finding Lazarus. Had you ever heard of him before we started doing this?
No.
So I definitely knew him from Dark Mind. I thought he was a personality, if that makes sense. Like a reporter or a host type person.
Right.
I did not realize these were his credentials. So here's where he comes into the story of Alex Cesney. Because of Cesney's criminal record and the work that detectives were doing on him, related to specifically the West Boylston motel rape case, and then the rape and murder of Teresa Stone, he sort of ends up being dubbed a serial killer.
Right. But from my understanding, the motel rape situation, he was acquitted of.
Yeah, he gets acquitted of that one. That was an accusation, not a conviction, if I said that wrong. Sorry.
You didn't say it wrong. So essentially, if you consider the fact that, while they gathered his DNA from that case, he wasn't found guilty of it. And so he's really got one crime, which would be the 1996 case that his DNA linked him to, right?
Yeah, he has that crime in 1996, but he has the other crimes I just sort of listed off that he was sentenced for the other rape. It's not a murder, though. So he's got the 1996 rape of Teresa Stone, the rape and murder of Teresa Stone. And then, as I mentioned, he also has this person unknown. So he has a charge where he's charged with the rape of a prostitute who doesn't show up for court and it's dropped. But then he's charged with attacking a woman with a necktie. And again, there's no outcome in here for that. But he's charged with raping a young girl under the age of 16 years old. So
when did that happen?
That case is from October 30th, 1999 in Leominster,
Massachusetts. So was he found guilty of that?
So they end up working on a plea deal. He was charged with the assault. It looks to me like a plea deal where they reduce the charge of rape of a child with force to a sentence for assault and battery that's a mixture of jail time and probation. So from July 14th, 2000 to July 13th, 2001, he's on probation for that crime. It is a sex crime, but he doesn't. So that's kind of pre-registry, or it's like right on the cusp of when people would go on a registry. That in mind, he's got basically four charges, we'll say, four cases. Is that better? Four cases. He ends up in CODIS because, okay, and this is another one of those cases. Like, if you're sensitive to this, I'm going to just lay out that there are some details here. Court records show that Alex Sesney in the Reservoir Motel, which is the case that ends up he's acquitted of, there were two yellow pillowcases recovered from the scene, and his semen samples were collected. He had been accused of anally raping the woman there. So those DNA profiles that come from that, because there's an element where the alleged victim says that Alex Sesney tried to smother her with a pillow while he is assaulting her, both sexually and physically, they put him in CODIS to see if there is a hit on his DNA. This comes from something he's acquitted of. So he goes into the combined DNA index system based on something he's alleged to have done that he ends up acquitted of. Make sense?
I hear you.
Okay. But then it hits on the rape and murder DNA evidence from the 1996 Teresa Stone case. So you're talking 12 years have passed, give or take. It's 11 years from the time of Teresa Stone's rape and murder to the time of this Reservoir Motel alleged rape. And I say that because he did go to trial for it, but he was ultimately found not guilty. He's acquitted.
He's acquitted of it, yeah.
Yeah, but they immediately arrest him for this other case. Well, what does John Kelly have to do with all this? John Kelly has a website at the time called Stalk Inc., which is STALKINC. Have you ever heard of Stalk Inc., by the way?
I have. System to Apprehend Lethal Killers Incorporated.
Yes, that would be the one. So, as this is all playing out in 2008, and this is ahead of what's happening with the other Reservoir Motel rape case, which he then is arrested for Teresa Stone's rape and murder. They get involved in February of 2008 as far as kind of publicizing this. But from 2007, after the other case had happened, they began to publish a profile. And they call it an evolving profile. Now, this is interesting. It's not very long. I looked at this, and what they're looking at is it's a Massachusetts serial killer. Now, this Massachusetts serial killer, from what I can tell, they have declared him to have 1, 2, 3, potentially 4 victims. Is that how you read the Mean South Woodsman victimology, that there's 4 of them?
I've read that that's what they said, yeah.
Okay.
I just want to be clear that that doesn't necessarily mean I'm agreeing with what they're saying, but yes, that's what's said.
Here's how this goes. In September 2003, 2 women's remains are found in shallow graves in a remote wooded area behind a school. This is a school located off of 404 Robin Hill Road. It's known as the Hillside School. There's a farm at this school, and William Sesney used to run the farm at this school. School's at 404 Robin Hill Road. The Sesney family, which includes Alex's older brother, Alex, and his father, among others, they lived at 217 Robin Hill. In March of 2004, the remains of another woman named Danelia Torres, who was 33, they end up found in Hudson. So we have Carmen Rudy, 28, and Bitzaida Montalvo found in 2003 behind this hillside school. And then in March of 2004, 2 miles away, we have Danelia Torres. The police putting all of this together, I guess they're sort of handed this on a silver platter. And I say that because if you look at it, he makes the ideal suspect candidate, having lived, you know, at 217 when they're buried at 404. I found that to be a little bit convenient. They do end up with more bodies being involved. And the next bodies are, in 2004, they find the body of a 40-year-old woman named Wendy Morello inside a trash can up in York, Maine. And then in 2007, a local woman to this area named Lenita Oliveira, she's found in Rutland State Forest. We basically have five victims that they're saying are a serial killer. Like, they're saying that this is a rapist killer of sex workers. That's the idea here. John Kelly doing his best to stay relevant. I mean, this guy's a talking head. Like all that list I read off earlier, there's something about him where he is, I don't want to say desperate for attention. What do you think of people like that are like kind of constantly?
I don't think anything about them really. They're just doing their thing.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder what their intentions are, if that makes sense. Like the Nancy Graces and John Washes of the world.
I like to think everybody's intentions are good. Doesn't mean they are, but that's where I try to, because otherwise I'm super negative, right?
Yeah.
And so I criticize and like I realize that it's important for people to, you know, continue their work and doing stuff like this. So, I mean, I feel like he's trying to solve a thing. Now, even best intentions sometimes, they either at the very best go nowhere, right? Or at the very worst, they cause confusion and it hinders different cases as opposed to helping them.
Yeah, I think that's a really good description of it, the hindering part, where I don't think that's on purpose. I think it just happens sometimes.
And I think that there's a, like, and I don't really know how to explain it because I'm not really a good teacher, and I have things in my mind that I understand that I don't know how to make you understand, right? Or other people to understand. I just understand them. It doesn't mean I'm right. Okay. But, you know, if you look at this situation with these five victims, I can see where he's coming from putting them all together like that. I don't necessarily agree, but I can see where he's coming from.
Yeah. No, I mean, I get into all sorts of situations where you make sure that I clarify, you know, I'm wandering off and speculating. I do it a lot. And when I do that, I'm not sitting around trying to, I'm not trying to cause problems or I think if I were to justify it, I'm not a talking head. If I were to justify what I was doing, I would say I'm trying to get people to think a little bit differently about some of the things they're presented, particularly when it comes to serial killers. Like my take on Otis Toole, Henry Lee Lucas, Ed Gein is completely different than most people's take on those people as serial killers go.
Right. And I think, you know, this case, the Maine Southwoodsman killing, it has hints, notes of like similarities to like the Jeff Davis 8, right?
Yeah. Kind of dumping ground feeling.
Right. And because of sort of the situation that Sesney found himself in, it was attributed to him in for convenience sake, probably. Now, there is DNA evidence on the murder he was convicted of.
Yeah, that's how, like, with the Teresa Stone murder, the way that he gets involved in that is DNA from the original crime. And it's not just semen, either. It's also blood. It's,
yeah, and that murder happened in 1996.
Correct. So he's not convicted of killing anyone else. That's it as far as...
And his conviction for that 1996 murder came quite a bit later.
Yeah, it's a lot later on. That case procedurally is decided in, like, so he has this Reservoir Motel rape case, and that happens where in 2007 he's acquitted of that, and then he's pretty much immediately arrested for the Teresa Stone murder. And then in March of 2012, they convict him in the Teresa Stone rape and murder. But then in 2015, the aggravated rape conviction is thrown out, which the felony murder conviction goes with it, but they keep in place the other two elements of first-degree murder, the other two counts of first-degree murder.
Right, and so he is in jail for the rest of his life based on the murder, the 1996 murder. He, I don't know if, like, gets credit is the right thing to say, but he, you know, these other murders are attributed to him. Now, part of the problem I'm having with this case, and maybe you can clear it up, I have information, obviously, about these five victims that, well, four of them were found in 2003 and 2004, and one was in 2007, and they're all in sort of a, they're close geographically, right?
They start out close geographically. Two of them are found elsewhere, one in Maine and one in Rutland Forest.
Right, but if you were just to, like, look at it on a map, like, it's in the same, the vicinity is not huge. It's not a huge stretch to, like, connect the dots there, right?
Okay, so
well, that's my opinion. This isn't really that important.
Okay.
What I'm getting at is, so I know that, I know when the bodies are found. What I had trouble with is figuring out, like, what happened, like, when were they missing people? How did that go down?
Okay, so that is a great question, and that's what
brings us here. What really matters is, like, what were the circumstances under which they went missing? Now, there, you know, there's little bits of information out there, but that's really where we need, you know, to go to figure out sort of what we're looking at here.
I would agree with that. And you're right. Like, proximity wise, these are all happening. Like, if you start at Massachusetts and sort of go away and north up to York, they're all happening in an interesting proximity to each other. John Kelly issues a profile in 2007. The official version of this shows up on the Stalk Inc. website, which is just stalkinc.com. Although I believe it is now defunct for the John Kelly site, you can find it on the Internet Archive. If you go to, like, archive.org and you go looking for it, it was originally under the web address stalkinc.com/profile3.htm. I'm going to read this off really quick and get your thoughts on what he's saying here. And the title of it is Evolving Profile on the Maine South Woodsman, Effective 9-17-07. So to be clear, this is Maine South Woodsman, M-A-I-N, as in the principal person, not Maine South Woodsman, as in the state, M-A-I-N-E. So it's M-A-I-N. And he says, we're expanding the previous information pertaining to the age of the woodsman. We profiled the age of the woodsman between 28 to 41 years old. However, we now believe that the age of the woodsman could be older than 41, but still not younger than age 28. And then that's the update they put on here. But what it says underneath is profile of a Worcester, Massachusetts serial killer. Gender, male and local to the area. Race is unknown at this time. The age is between the ages of 28 to 41, which they later update to say it could be up of 41. Vocations, works in the construction field or is or has been a truck driver or a maintenance worker. His hobbies include fishing, hunting, and pornography in all forms of media. His legal history is a history of assaulting women. He probably assaulted some prostitutes who got from him, and I believe they meant to say got away from him. He would have charges of breaking and entering, a history of DUIs or possession of illegal substance. He may have even been known as a drug dealer. He has a history, although it may be not a legal history, of cruelty to animals, trespassing, and being a peeping Tom. Mental history, and again, these are their words, not mine. This psychopath suffers from a learning disability and suffers from anxiety and paranoia. Drug and alcohol history. The perpetrator is a heavy smoker who abuses alcohol, marijuana, and at times cocaine. He probably has received some treatment for alcohol or substance abuse. Psychosocial history. He grew up in a very physically and sexually abusive household as a child, blames his mother for the abusive situation. He is addicted to frequenting areas of prostitution. He is known to prostitutes in the main south area of Worcester. He may be known to prostitutes as being a John who prefers sex outdoors, weather permitting. He's a compulsive bragger who brags about his fishing and hunting exploits. He would brag about and enjoy showing pictures of his fishing and hunting conquests. His vehicle, he drives a pickup truck or a large SUV. And then it says underneath, we will be reporting much more about this particular predator in the following weeks. He should turn himself into the authorities to end his personal, tortuous torment and his addiction to killing. He can then tell his story to the millions of people who are interested in him. And they have a little sideline here that has two other pieces on it. The first one, in quotes, says, may God bless Wendy Morello. Wendy Morello's murder seems to reveal the most information to help identify the woodsman. Wendy was last seen at her friend's residence in Massachusetts, and it's the same area, between 4 and 5 a.m. on September the 5th of 2004. She was said to have run out of the room to get into a vehicle with someone and supposedly was not dressed up to work on the street at the time. Instead, she was wearing jeans, sneakers, and a black shirt. We believe she knew the person in the vehicle and felt safe with him. She was never seen again. Her body is found September 13th, 2004 on Riverwood Drive in York, Maine. When she was found, she was in a plastic garbage can wearing a white shirt, not the black one she left the house in. This suggests to us that Mrs. Morello stayed with the person for some length of time before she was killed. She knew him, she felt safe with him, and she stayed with him. Where did she stay with him is the question. Is there a person who owns or rents a building where prostitutes from Maine South in Massachusetts feel safe going to in order to get high or turn tricks for money or drugs? We believe the girls from Maine South probably have the answer to that question. That's the first add-on to this original profile thing. The power is in the questions is the second add-on. And this comes from February the 4th, 2008. A question that begs to be answered is where the woodsman got the white prep cook's shirt, which he gave to Wendy Morello. And Wendy is misspelled in that, spelled W-I, and her name is actually W-E, and it's spelled correctly elsewhere. How did he have access to such a shirt? Did he work in a place where such shirts were required? Did he transport such shirts for one reason or another? Or does he have access to a place where such shirts may be stored? The prostitutes working in the Maine South District may be able to relate a John to one or more of these questions. Okay, so that's the profile. What do you think of the profile?
Well, I'm curious. I heard you say when you were just sort of reading off there that there would be much more released in the weeks to come. And since we have the benefit of the passage of time, it being 22 and all now, that was in 2007 and with an update in 08, it sounded like. Was there a lot of additional information released?
Is that a rhetorical question or you want me to answer it?
Well,
I can't tell.
Well, it did say that, right?
It did say that, yes. And there have been multiple articles that quote that part and further quote John Kelly and the members of Stalk as saying that, yes.
Right. And, you know, and when you're saying that, and it sounds really enticing and to anticipate that, right? It's also like, I don't know where that was published. I'm sure you said it, but I didn't hear, or I don't remember.
That starts from their website, Stalk Inc. It's quoted verbatim and in paraphrases in multiple media sources.
Right. And the whole point was, like, they were trying to get the information to the person, right? The problem being that I don't know that they were – okay, so you asked me what I think about the profile. I feel like the profile is a very – it's very broad.
Yeah, it's a pretty generic assessment.
Right, and it – you know, I'm sure they had their reasons for why they said things like that. And I know profiling is useful – and, you know, it was a huge deal. And I don't know if you've noticed, but, you know, now profilers aren't profilers anymore. They're now like analysts. But, you know, it to know like what type of person you're looking for is like a really good thing. But it can also be like a really bad thing.
Yeah.
Because you start to whittle down things and it can make people who should absolutely be suspects not suspect.
Yeah.
And vice versa. And so I don't know. I don't think a whole lot about the profile. I feel like I've always felt like most profiles would be throwing everything against the wall to see what sticks.
Yeah, I went hunting to see what the true crime community sort of thought of what was going on with Alex Sesney and this Maine South Woodland case. I think it's best summarized with this is from a Facebook page from June of 2019. The Facebook page is titled Ted Bundy Talks True Crime, which take it for what you want. I think it's hilarious. He pulled a bunch of the sources together, and this is sort of how he summarized who was the Maine South Woodsman, a.k.a. the Woodsman of – and I don't know how you say – I always said this in my head as Worcester, but I was told it's pronounced Wooster. It's W-O-R-C-E-S-T-E-R. That's the city we're talking about. If anybody wants to correct me, feel free to send me a message and tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. This is what Ted Bundy Talks has to say. On September 24, 2003, a couple of students were cutting through a patch of woods near their school in Marlborough, Massachusetts. As they were hiking through the wood, they came across a patch of brush. They were picking up indiscriminate pieces of branches and twigs and began horseplaying. When one of the boys picked up what they thought was a branch, the branch, when held up, took on a whole new turn. It was the skeletal remains of what appeared to be a human arm. After stepping back and pushing some of the brush away, they realized they had stumbled upon a complete skeleton. Betzaida, B-E-T-Z-A-I-D-A, Montalva, 29, had been reported missing at the beginning of April the same year. So this is September this happens, the end of September, September 24th. Betzaida Montalva had been reported missing in April that year. Montalva soon identified. She's a resident of the nearby W city in Massachusetts, and authorities knew she was known to authorities as a drug addict that had been working as a prostitute in the Maine South neighborhood. Unfortunately, the remains had suffered the elements of a wooded area in the cold country of New England, so no evidence was obtained and no cause of death was determined, which makes it very much like the Jeff Davis case.
All right.
Exactly. There's more to this, but I wanted you to chime in here.
Okay, so what I'm looking for is April of 2003 is when she was noticed to be missing, right?
Yeah.
Do you have any additional information about the circumstances surrounding her disappearance. What you said with Wendy Morello, where she left on September the, I think, 8th, and she was found September the 13th. So you're looking at 5 days there, right?
Yeah, this one's the longer one for me. It's 5 months. One of the longer ones.
Okay, and like, do we have the circumstances of her? Because when I looked for her as a missing person, I didn't find anything.
No, like they're all pretty similar that way. There is some paperwork on it, but the paperwork is done way after the fact, where I don't have any faith in it. They're just incident reports, and they report very, you know, how we talk about how some things all get lumped into January. These are January cases. Like sometime in, basically in January of 2004, there are reports about the others saying nobody knows where they went. And, but I could give you, there are some more specifics here from Ted Bundy Talks True Crime. So I'll give you that. And so the authorities, they span this wooded area where these kids are, and they're looking for any kind of evidence they can unearth. And they bring in cadaver canines. So 5 days later, on September the 29th, so we're still in 2003, they come across another set of human remains. Now, this is Carmen Ruby. She's 29, and she had been reported missing at the end of 2002. But she was also known to be a sex worker in the Maine South area. Okay? So yeah, that's two. So you've got one missing in April of 03. You've got one missing at the end of 02.
Right.
All right,
they're found very close together within 5 days.
Their bodies were found. Yeah, and I've read different accounts where like they're partially buried, and I don't know how true that is, but they are very close to each other. These are the ones that are found over off of Robin Hill Road. A few months later, on March the 4th, 2004, the skeletal remains of yet another woman from the Maine South area who was also a sex worker named Denelia Torres, who's 33, she's discovered. Now, she had been missing since August of 03. The frustrating thing at this point is that these dump sites are yielding no evidence. So basically, they're not finding any clues as to what's happened, but the bodies have been left there long enough that the bodies aren't even helping them. So it says the authorities and the increasingly worried group of residents in the area of Maine South are left to wonder, are they dealing with a serial killer? Months pass. There's no answers. There's no leads. There's no suspects. On September 13, 2004, their worries would only be heightened when yet still another body is found, except this time it's not in the same 20-mile area near Maine South. Wendy Morello, who we've already talked about, she gets reported missing on September 5th. And she's found 8 days later on September 13th.
Okay, I got that backwards earlier. Sorry.
That's all right. Her body is the one that's found in a wooded area up in York, Maine, in a plastic garbage can. And there's an address attached to this somewhere, because I'm going to look to see if that house was for sale at that time. As horrible as this situation was, investigators knew that this could be the find that may help them produce some solid evidence because of the short period of time from when Morello disappears and her body is found. It's only 8 days between the two.
Now, does anything spark there for you?
What do you mean?
Well, like,
why is this attached to the others?
Well, with regard to the Maine South Woodsman, you know, killer or whatever, it is very relevant that you're talking about 8 days here as opposed to, like, you know, 8 months.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a huge difference, but also it's not a body left out in a wooded area. It's a plastic garbage can. That's what gets found. Somebody looked at the trash can and said, what's that doing here? That's the difference.
Right, but, and so, you know, the comment is made that, you know, oh, maybe we'll finally get some evidence, right?
Right.
Well, was there evidence?
No. Well, let me keep going for a minute, and then we'll come back to that question. That's a good question. I have some theories on, like, what's going on, some of the stuff going on here. So silence falls over the case for the next few years. This is Ted Bundy talking. silence for the next few years. So that's 2004 and then silence. But with every Maine South missing persons report would come a deep sense of anxiety. That anxiety would be impacted most on September the 4th of 2007. On September 4th, 2007, a deer hunter 12 miles outside of the Maine South area in Rutland State Park, he stumbles across the remains of Lenita Oliveira, 34. Now, she had been reported missing in May of 2007, but the last known contact with her that I can find is January of 2007. But again, this is now a decomposed body in the advanced stages when they find her in September. Summer months have happened. So this case is open as of 2019 in this writing, and it's still open now. So those are his words, the case is open, and those are my words, the case is open. There are a lot of things that the authorities apparently do have that are they're keeping on a close to the vest or on a need-to-know basis. Anything that they recovered from Wendy Morello, they don't release, or they have not released. The similarities of these women are all five women are known drug addicts and all are sex workers. They all have ties to Maine South, this neighborhood. They're all petite. They were all moms and they were all found in wooded areas near water. Now, TBT, as he's known, Ted Bundy's talking true crime. He closes out talking about a person of interest, and this is 2019. He says that sometime in 2007, a man named Alex F. Sesney, 38, was brought up on charges of rape and assault in West Boylston. That's the motel, Reservoir Motel attack. When DNA was collected from that crime, it was ran against the CODIS database, and a match came up from it. Actually, he says a database, which I understand what he's getting at there, because I couldn't confirm it was CODIS. Although that was speculated by people, it's not outright said that they ran it against CODIS. It's just said that it was run against Crime Lab database, and it's Massachusetts State Police that did it. So a match comes up from the 1996 rape murder of Teresa Stone, 39. Although the 2007 rape case charges were eventually dismissed, that's not correct. He was actually acquitted. Sesney was charged in Stone's murder in 2008, and he was subsequently convicted in 2012. He was born and raised in the same vicinity where the first three victims were found. So that's a reference to him having lived on Robin Hill Road. Sesney has had several violent and sex assault charges brought against him since 1996. And he had been accused of beating and trying to strangle a known prostitute. He was brought up on charges of attacking a girl under the age of 16. Each time the charges were reduced or dropped when the victims did not show in court. That's not true either. He actually had a plea deal for assault, but I guess reduce would apply there. He did do a little bit of time and he did probation. In 2002, Cape County authorities arrested him when he was accused of raping and then attempting to strangle the victim with a necktie. He was released with dismissed charges because that victim died. This is the woman with the necktie case.
She didn't die because of the incident, though.
I can't find that.
Then the charges wouldn't be dismissed. They'd be upgraded. I mean,
she was just unavailable to be part of the prosecution. So I don't believe it's related to that. I don't know. Bristol County authorities have said that he is a person of interest in 11 homicides in the New Bedford area in the late 1980s. And that is the New Bedford Highway killer. So, and he cites his sources here. Ted Bundy Talks does. He cites the Midford Daily News, the Stalk Inc., a masscops.com article, telegram.com article, a Metro West Daily News.com article, which is actually about John Kelly, a masslive.com article, and a couple of YouTube videos that he's quoting here.
And if I can just take a second. So, you know, this isn't because I know everything. This is just, I find it relevant and I think you probably do too. You know, when someone's acquitted of something, it's different than if the charges are dismissed. And, if somebody, you know, has charges dismissed versus, or is found guilty versus takes a plea deal, right? All this stuff is relevant here, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, you just had a very well-cited, you know, account of it that had mistakes in it. And so it starts It is semantics, but it can be relevant.
So here's where we leave off with this particular episode, because believe it or not, there's more to this. So where we're at right now is John Kelly releases a profile on a guy that they're calling the Maine South Woodsman. He's also known as the Woodsman of Worcester. I have no idea how you actually pronounce that city in Massachusetts. I apologize to the two people who listen to us in Massachusetts. I'm just clarifying there. So John Kelly thinks it could be potentially Alex Sesney, and he gets behind that, but he's really just behind his profile and he's trying to get his name out there. And now we have New Bedford entering the picture from also Massachusetts, where they have an unidentified serial killer responsible for the deaths of at least 9 women and 2 other disappearances. They think that Alex Sesney might also be the New Bedford highway killer. That's a lot to put on some guy for a rape and murder in 1996, don't you think?
I don't even know what to say. It's ridiculous. I can't make the leap. I'm having trouble following. Am I the only one?
No, you're not alone in that.
Okay, I'm not sure. Like, this case is interesting, but I mean, do they just have nobody else that they can consider?
Oh, no, that's what we're getting to in next week's episode. Thank you for joining us. We are sponsored by LabbrotiCreations.com. You can check them out at LabbrotiCreations.com, and you can still use the code CRIMEXS for a fun pop pet portrait of your own pet. You can also reach us on Twitter, Instagram, at TrueCrimeXS. Or you can give us a call if you know anything about any of the cases that we're talking about at 252-365-5593. You can also reach us at Gmail at truecrimexs@gmail.com. And you can check out our website at www.truecrimexs.com. We'll see you next time.
So it's sort of interesting how much we've learned about serial killers these last couple of years. Like, we knew the basics, but there's something that changes when you actually start sitting down and comparing what a serial killer is said to have done with what you can prove they've done. And, you know, the other thing we've learned is these profiles are incredibly generic overall. And I get where some of the information comes from, and some of it feels sort of a little made up. But when we sit down and go through what we've been looking at to put up for cases, like some of this stuff we recorded months ago. And what's happened since then is I've gotten involved with a project that involves sort of the opposite of this, where, like, what if a serial killer wanted to be a talking head, which is very complicated to explain right now. But it's interesting. I've learned a lot from looking at all of the aspects of that project. The other side of this is, you know, it's the end of summer. Everybody's now getting back into their school year and their work year. And we have, like, a really kind of a serious tragedy where an acquaintance of one of my kids was killed, was murdered. And I, you know, when you have teenagers and you like, we live in an area where that never happens. So for this to be something that they're suddenly dealing with, it's very interesting how ill-equipped I find myself with trying to explain the evil in the world. And I think that's probably one of the most important things that Meg and I are trying to do with to continue to host content that's, you know, essentially about, like, the bad things that happen in the world, the most tragic things. And when we start talking about a case like this, I think it can sound like we're talking a little bit out of our head. But the truth is, when we have to weigh what is in the mainstream media versus what isn't in the mainstream media, there aren't a lot of options unless we want to just sit down and cover the same cases over and over again. And that is not something that we would do. We wouldn't take the time to sit down each week and just cover a case because it sounds like, I don't know, maybe we'll do that like with a case or two, but we're not going to do that. We're always looking at elements that make these cases sort of impossible. So yeah, we do these little odd mini series where we talk about different killers and different tragedies. And this case is no less a tragedy sort of all around, because we feel like the people that have poked their noses in some ways have hindered the case, of several cases, actually kept them from being solved. And that's really, really, really confusing to us. And part of us, I think, as audience members of other types of true crime, it's frustrating for us. So we're hoping that what we continue to talk about will have a little more weight than just, you know, repeating ourselves in documentaries and spouting out profiles that make little sense in the grand scheme of cases. But probably the most interesting thing that's happened out of all of this, you know, work, because it is work, even if it's unappreciated work, it's work nonetheless, even for the guys like Don Kelly. What it has done that's affected us is I basically metaphorically went back and wiped the slate clean on the Israel Keyes case. And I said, okay, let's start over. I'll look at the interviews one more time, listen to the interviews one more time, look at their words, and I will take them with a new approach. And that's what I've done. Now, it's interesting because I think that's actually where Meg started, and she just kind of went along for the ride with the rest of it. But like three or four of her cases stick, like they're still there. With mine, I took some really key things that I think everyone missed, because I originally said I think the FBI missed it. But since then, everyone in true crime, myself included, seems to have missed some of the things that he's saying very specifically. And now that I've started getting into this sort of hot air balloon with multiple different jurisdictions, cold case investigators, and sort of going, hey, you've got this case, can I talk to you about it? And this is, you know, sending them, you know, time coded pieces of transcripts related to what Israel Keyes is saying and comparing it to, you know, cases they have in their jurisdiction that just sat there open. We found some very interesting key components to it all. I'm confident that almost all of the cases that I've been looking at could easily be ruled in or out. And I think like three of them are hits. Like I think three of those cases at a minimum are attributable to Israel Keyes and not in a John Kelly kind of way, which it's ironic we're talking about that guy because Dark Minds is where I think probably most people found out about Israel Keyes the very first time with Phelps and with Kelly. But so that's where we're at, is like this is sort of the setup to tee off to do a little bit more. It's like I said, there's some very interesting people involved from the law enforcement perspective. They're not FBI. They're locals who like have a case they want solved, and their stories might make something that seemed like another season, but it's not another season on Keyes, because realistically, you know, that car runs out of gas pretty fast. And even with the cases that I'm like, there's one that I'm thinking of right now. It's a good story. I've talked to the family. I sort of prepped them and warned them, hey, this is where I'm headed with, what I think happened. Because they had an advocate or two in there. And then I started talking to law enforcement. I didn't talk to them first because I really wanted at least one person in the family to sort of get a consensus and sign off on what I was doing. And once that happened, I was like, all right, now it's time to talk to law enforcement about what I'm seeing here. And it didn't take long to get two of the jurisdictions on board where they were like, oh yeah. Now in some of the other instances, it's going to take longer. It's not always like a positive thing. I did find something in Texas that I can't explain, and that'll make a good story, but I don't know if it's a Keyes related story. So we sort of find ourselves in this boat where it's like, all right, which which case and which content do we cover next? And unfortunately, I wish I could just go, oh, it's going to be a season about X cases. And it just doesn't turn out that way for us in terms of time and resources, because some things that you're investigating now, you won't actually have put together for 6 months, but it is what it is.